Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 99%, where the real gains are made. This episode is brought to you by Venga CBD. All of us on the podcast are pretty new to CBD, and Venga has a cool new feature where you can take a quiz to see what personalized CBD plan might be right for you. So if you are interested, I recommend you go check it out and take their quiz and kind of see what their plan recommends for you. And then, you know, give it a whirl and maybe it'll help. Maybe you'll be like Elliot and it'll be the greatest thing since sliced bread. I don't know, but it's worth a checkout, eh?
It's, I would say, equal to PBJ, which if you know me, that's high praise. It's not like I ate one just before we, I had Venga CBD today and a PBJ. So, and it's vengaendurance.com. So, and we have a discount code as well.
And it'll be in the show notes.
Yeah. Hop on. Give it a whirl. I think it's worth your time. It's worth my time.
We also have Marilyn with us.
Hey, guys.
And we're going to talk about a few things today. We actually had a listener question about heat. So we're going to do a quick little rapid fire here on heat, especially as it relates to cycling and how you need to adjust intensity when you're riding, or if you need to adjust intensity. Elliot is pretty passionate about this answer. He really wanted to take a power stance on this, so he's gonna kick it off.
That is not what happened. So the specific that is
there was a power stance earlier. There was a power stance.
Yes, I have hints of former strength that you can see, but I cannot access. But anyways, the specific question was essentially, how do you adjust power for heat? And it's going to change for every person, but generally speaking, everyone's going to go a little bit slower if it gets hotter, but you can adapt to the heat, but you can't adapt all the way. So like if you're optimally performing at 60 degrees Fahrenheit, and then all of a sudden you're in 90 degrees and it's humid, you're going to perform slower no matter who you are. But if you are better trained to the heat, you will perform less slower. I think we all agree on that part, right?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That was a power stance. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And so like how I handle this is not all that scientific, but essentially I'm always having my athletes try to focus on their effort and what they're in. This athlete, the question was talking about Ironman effort in the heat. And so like, how do you gauge that new Ironman effort now that you're going to be racing in much hotter, warmer conditions? And certain people, if you want to do a bunch of testing, you can figure that number out exactly, but you kind of have to know what the temperature is going to be on the race day and where you started. So I just skip all that and have people focus on realistic effort and how it feels and not so much what that power number is. And then it's just an ongoing conversation about how that feels. So my athletes who just raced Coeur d'Alene went into it and said, holy heck, I haven't ridden in 100 degrees all year, because they're not from the desert like you guys. And so then, did we adjust power numbers? Did we have ballpark lower numbers? Yes, but it was all super ballpark and it was all kind of about feel. And so eventually I gave them a top end, don't go over this number, but so much of that wasn't really based on a hard science. It was more based on the soft science of, we reviewed past workouts in not quite as hot temperatures and then compared and contrast and made a best guess. But at the end of the day, we just let the athlete make the decision on the day with what they feel is, what they feel is the appropriate effort. Cause I'm more concerned about effort, which usually correlates more to heart rate, than the actual power number. So anyways, I'm going to shut up and let you guys answer.
Yeah. That wasn't much of a rapid fire, but we'll take it.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I thought it was shorter than it was, but yeah.
Marilyn, do you want to jump in, or you need to jump in?
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy to, obviously, he is near and dear to my heart. That's something that I've done a lot of racing in and live in a lot. My nickname used to be the Desert Lizard, and I coach a lot of people through some pretty successful hot races. Just same thing, had two athletes at Coeur d'Alene, both of them qualified for Kona. So it was a 2 for 2, which was really, really a great day for us. And The big thing I say to people is you're exactly what you were talking about, Ellie, is cross-referencing not only how they feel, but the big indicator I like to make people aware of is watch that heart rate like it's the heat gauge on your car. You know, that overheat engine light on your car is pretty important. That thing starts to overheat, and like you see cars sitting on the side of the road going up in a pile of smoke, the same thing's going to happen to you. So, you know your efforts feel sometimes early in the day in a hot race, you feel pretty good and it doesn't feel so bad, but you know, the heat catches up with you later on. So I encourage people to back off, you know, somewhere and keep them in really, really aerobic, watch their heart rate, cooling strategies early. And specifically to answer the question, if it's how many watts are we going to need to back off? If someone's racing at, let's say, I like to use zones, if we're at the top of your aerobic zone for Ironman typically, and maybe crossing over into a little bit of zone three when you're getting up and down the hills, that kind of thing, never going into threshold. When it's really, really hot out, you're probably going to stay more the low end of zone two and really never cross into zone three and really, really regulating effort the whole day and just making sure, hey, if my heart rate starts creeping up, don't even look at your watts and get... My big thing I said to them is get as much speed as possible when the race is fast and your effort is low. And when it's hard and you think you're going to be overheating that engine and the heart rate's going to start climbing up, that's when you really, really want to back off and practice cooling strategies. And that's going to save your engine for the day. So those were my top tips to my athletes there on the bike. And that saved them to be able to complete the race really well. And that was a 100-degree race. That's why I like to use that one as a, you know, an example that happened recently.
Yeah, that was a toasty one. That I had a little bit of FOMO for not being there, but also I was like, man, that looks hard. Yeah, I think like I like to have the conversation with athletes, and don't quote me on these numbers, but it's like on the bike, we're what, like 20 to 25% efficient, and the other 78% of our energy is dissipated as heat. So you are generating a ton of heat. You know, if you're riding at 200 watts, you're dissipating 600 watts worth of heat, something like that. Like that's just what I like to think about as far as like how much heat you're creating. So if you're right, if you're doing that and you're in 100 degree temperatures, that heat is not going to dissipate. And you're also getting warm from the outside in, as well as warming your body from the inside out. So heat is a big factor that you always need to think about in any temperature, because you're creating so much of it, right? So when you're dealing with outside heat, it's definitely something to really consider. And then the other piece of that is, I think the preparation, like you guys talked about, is really important. Like if you can teach your gut to handle drinking a ton of water in order to help yourself stay hydrated and also be able to digest food in the heat, I think those two things are really important for being able to survive the race. So those two things coupled with how much preparation you have in the heat, like as far as riding and experience you have and how you know, like how you know how much your body can handle, I think that all really affects how much you need to adjust, right? If you're training in Tucson and it's 100 degrees all the time, and that's where you're used to your Ironman effort and you're used to being able to drink 3 bottles of water an hour, then maybe you don't need to adjust your pacing strategy very much. But if you're in Montana and you're riding in 50 degree weather all the time, it's really easy to dissipate heat there, then you might need to really consider lowering that pacing strategy. But again, I think I'm not going to really even talk about pacing, because I think you guys really nailed it with lowering a little bit, going on feel, using heart rate. I agree with all those things. One question I was going to ask you guys is, do you ever like alternate like cadence strategy or anything like that to say, I want to keep the heart rate down? So if you get in a situation where your heart rate is high, do you guys ever talk about like slow rolling cadence a bit to try and lower that heart rate?
It works. It just depends on the athlete and the athlete's feel. So certainly like there's a few people I coach who tend towards a much higher cadence and they're just more comfortable there. And anytime they do that lower cadence stuff, they just like muscularly endurance wise, they're just not there. But there's a reason that like Chrissy Wellington and Daniela Reif ride a really low cadence and they're some of the best athletes ever. And their muscular endurance is just through the roof, and they're able to exactly what you said. It's an easier way to make power with less heat and less heartbeats. However, if you're not prepared for it, it can really bite you in the butt. So I personally haven't had too many athletes who fit that bill. I've had a few and I definitely bring it up. But generally speaking, I haven't gotten to use it too much just because of the folks I coach's personal physiology.
Yeah, I would say that strategy works on parts of the course that are fast, like slight downhills and flats. But if the course is uphill and hard and the bike starts moving slowly and they're generating a lot of force just to get up the hill and they're grinding along at a really, really heavy, you know, heavy gear and a heavy effort, and it can actually work against them. So if it's a slight downhill or it's flat and heart rate's up, you know, cadence is a little high, they can click it up a couple gears, keep the speed high on the bike, lower the heart rate, and you know, maybe that's going to help them from overheating a little bit. But if it's a false flat up or certainly any kind of roller or climb, grinding it out in a massive gear just to roll at a lower cadence, that's actually going to be a higher work rate. And I think that's going to make the athlete, like you said, Elliot, you know, muscularly, it's going to fatigue them for the run, but also it's going to generate maybe just a little bit more heat and work against them in that strategy. So course dependent for sure, and can fluctuate depending on how the course rolls and you know, how fast your bike's moving. If your bike's moving really, really slow and you're grinding along in a big gear and you're going even slower, that's probably the wrong gear to be in.
Yeah, totally. A lot of force per pedal stroke there.
Mm-hmm. What is awesome. Your thought, Jesse?
I mean, you guys did a good job. I think it can work on occasion. Like I think if your heart rate is really high and you're like, okay, for like 2 or 3 minutes, I'm going to slow my cadence down a little bit. But again, I agree. Like if you're on a massive climb, you don't want to start rolling a cadence of 40 if you're already at like 70 or something, you know? So I think it can work in moments, and I've definitely done it on at times and have recommended athletes can do it for shorter amounts of time at the right time on the course to help lower that heart rate and, you know, get some, like whether you're trying to drink a bunch of water or just get your heart rate down for a few minutes. But yeah, you want to keep the force per pedal stroke like in check.
Nice.
Let's talk about keeping your bike upright.
Topic of the day.
It doesn't always happen. We've all gone down. Nobody likes it. Nobody likes coming back from crashing. And yeah.
Wait,
so,
do we need to state there are two kind of cyclists, and they are those who have crashed and those who will crash. Have you never heard that?
Yeah, I've definitely heard
that. I was like, Marilyn knew where I was going. Jesse's giving me a blank look. And I was like, this is because Jesse hasn't crashed enough. You need to crash more, Jesse.
Definitely part of cycling. It's like, you always say well, we always say like, welcome to the club. Now you're a real cyclist.
Yeah, definitely. That definitely happened to me at my first crash. Anyways, we interrupted you, Jesse. Carry on.
No, you're good. You're good. I would like to avoid being a member of that club for as long as possible. not that I haven't crashed, but.
I saw you crash. Well, I didn't see it.
Right. Oh, come on. I toppled over. That's not like a crash. I was leading a group ride. Couldn't clip in, had my front wheel stuck.
We did the Chino course in your hand.
Wait, when was
like, oh
this?
My God, you're home. Okay, you guys know. Oh man,
I did. That's two crashes. That's two crashes. Darn it. I was going to tell a third crash story too. Man. Well, okay. So now I toppled over leading a group ride with Marilyn and got a lot of flack from a bunch of her athletes for that one. Had my front wheel stuck in a crack and couldn't clip in and did the classic topple over. But yeah, Marilyn and I were on a gravel ride and I buried my front wheel and my hand turned purple because I flipped. But those aren't even my bad crashes. Elliot,
you're part of the club.
I'm part of the club.
But you don't even know it.
I also crashed going down Madera when it was icy. And that's a big climb in Tucson. And that one has been a little more tricky for me to get over. I have trouble staying with the group every time going down that descent now, which is kind of more the crashes I think we want to get into on this podcast. Right.
The ones that kind of scare you.
Yeah, the ones that kind of stick with you, like oatmeal in the morning, a little too long. Do you guys have...
We're basically, the big thing that we want to dive into today is like, one, like you just said, is... everybody crashes at some point if we're riding bikes, whether it be, you know, whether it's your fault or another rider's fault or with a altercation with a car or something like that. And then it's like, how do we, so one, how do we prevent these from happening a little bit more and become aware of what we could do to prevent them? And then two, if it happens, how do we get over it and get to a place where we're past that and able to ride our bikes and as happy and as, you know, aggressively and as carefree as we always did before the crash happened, right?
And safely.
And safely, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess for starters, you guys have all crashed.
Yes.
And how was that comeback for you personally? And what did you taken away from that for helping athletes come back? Let's stick with, I guess, like, let's leave physically out of this for now, because let's assume, you know, you're working with a PT or whatever else, and we have some impact injuries that we can get over. But yeah, I don't know where you want to start with that kind of ball of question.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I've had a lot of different types of crashes. So I have been hit by a car a couple of times. One of them was from behind. So that's like the one that scares people the most, because you don't see it coming. You know, when you get T-boned from the side or you see it coming from the front, you know, you maybe have some time to react or prepare. Whether that's better or not, I don't know. But when it comes out of nowhere from behind, that can be pretty scary for people. And
can you set the scene for that a little bit, just because, like, not all of us
haven't been T-boned,
or I've never been hit from behind. I've only had an interaction with the car, like me hitting the car for them, like, you know, turning right in front of me or whatever. And then, yeah, you know, it's happening. And I agree, that sounds really scary. And,
right.
So yeah. Like, kind of lay out the scene. Like, how were you riding? Were you riding?
Yeah.
What would we deem as safely? Yeah. Were you doing everything right? Did you make some mistakes there? And then kind of what happened?
So that's the thing, is that, like, we can be doing everything right, and sometimes these things just happen. So a friend of mine and I were riding side by side in a big bike lane inside the white line, on a route that we do all the time. It's ridden by a lot of cyclists, and we were just chatting away, and it was like a grenade went off just from out of nowhere, just boom, this big noise. And all of a sudden I remember hopping up out of the ditch, and, you know, our bikes were everywhere. I kind of, you know, hopped up. I was however many feet away from my bike. I look, I see my friend kind of crumpled up in the side of the road, and go into emergency mode for my friend to make sure that she's okay. And, you know, call the ambulance, direct people that are around, those kinds of things. And so it is very much a, like, we were just riding along safely by the rules, and then just bam, out of nowhere, this happens. And, you know, it's been interesting going through that process versus, obviously, I've had a lot of bike crashes where it's like, oh, I rubbed wheels with someone. And actually, the worst injury I've ever had in my life, and it almost ended my triathlon career, but essentially really did run, and a running part of my career, is that I got caught in someone's back skewer and landed butt first right on the pavement, ruptured my hamstring off the bone. And, you know, so something as simple as that to really big, epic bike crashes in big bike races, and, you know, even just following someone too fast downhill and hitting a pothole. I've crashed and smacked my head pretty hard doing that. So all kinds of crashes like that. But the one that we're talking about where you're just riding along, following all the rules, and then out of nowhere, a car hits you. And these are the ones that people are afraid of the most now, because it's, you know, the cars are with texting and distracted driving and those kinds of things. And it was an interesting process that for me, what I went through to come back to be on the bike and feel confident, the series of emotions that I went through versus the friend that I was riding with, what her process has been to get back out on the road. They've been completely polar opposite of one another. For me, I got back out there right away. I sort of consciously, very verbally, out loud made the decision. I was asked, do you want to still ride a bike? And I said, yes. And then the person said to me, well, if you want to ride a bike, then you need to no hums or haws, clip in and get back out there. And I did that right away. And I actually went through the area that I was hit fairly quickly after being hit with a group of friends. It was funny, when we went through that section, all my friends sort of swarmed around me like a group of bees, and we were all dead silent. We just rolled through it really fast. And then it was kind of like, whew, made it through. But what I did notice is that for a long period of time, anytime a car went past me a little bit closer than what I felt comfortable, I was I was very angry. Like every time a car went by and was a bit too close, I turned into like this maniac road rage person inside my own head. Like I wasn't scared, but I was like, yeah, I mean, I would start yelling and swearing at the car and like flipping out. And I was like, wow, where'd that come from? Like I've never used to be that aggro at cars. And that lasted a while. Eventually it completely went away. Now I still, every now and then, if a car goes by a little too close, too fast, I flinch a lot more than I used to. My friend who was in the accident with me, who was hurt much more than I was, is about a year and a half before she even went back out on the road. She just rode the trainer and the bike path, and she still has problems with certain roads and cars. And it was really just a couple of weeks ago that we rode together through that exact same spot again and went through it successfully. And what was interesting is we went through it and I kept her real distracted the whole time because she doesn't remember the accident. She said to me after we went through it, she goes, have we been through the spot yet? And I said, yeah, we went through it about 5 minutes ago. And she was like, oh, wow. But I purposely engaged a very serious conversation with her a few minutes, like as we were approaching that area and all the way through it. So she was thinking about what we were talking about because it was so intense what we were talking about much more than even going through that area. So that's a really long-winded answer, but yeah, that's been, I can talk about this topic a lot with some personal experiences.
It's just like turbulence on an airplane. So I don't know. It's the same idea, right? You just, if you're talking to someone, it's also a great idea. Essentially, you're saying for both yourself and your friend, you both came back to it at much different timelines, but you both did the exact same thing, which is essentially face your fears, but have somebody there holding your hand while you do it.
Yeah.
And like, don't do it alone. It's real easy to kind of panic. And that's the same way. My first real crash was actually in my first crit ever. I tail gunned it for the first half of the crit, was terrified because I did not have hardly any bike racing experience. Realized it wasn't so bad, moved straight to the front of the race, rode like five laps. And I'm like, I'm going to be the best bike racer ever. This is so easy. It took me half an hour to figure this out. And then I'm riding second wheel and the kid in front of me crashes, lays out all over the road. I lock up and then five guys end up on top of me. And I'm like, do I stink at this? But I was super lucky in that I was on a team that was essentially, it wasn't a development team. It was just a bunch of like really excited 4 or 5 racers. And then like a kid like me who was 19. And then it was a stage race. So we had to race the next day and I was terrified, but I had people who'd crashed before who did the exact same thing for me as you did. And I did not plan on talking to about this today because I hadn't even thought about it. But it's exactly what you and your friend did. You know, you had your friends swarm around you. You went with your friend when she came back on her timeline. I walked away like essentially uninjured, just, you know, aside from a bloody butt. But I mean, we've all been there. But I had these people who were like, okay, yeah, this is how you crashed. This is why you crashed. Like, this wasn't necessarily your fault. These are things you could have done differently. You know, and to be aware of that, and every crash is different, but knowing kind of like the why of what it happened and what you can control and what you can't control. And then kind of just like recognizing, are you personally comfortable with that risk? And if you're not comfortable with the risk, which is exactly what someone asked you, Marilyn, right? If you're not comfortable with the risk, then don't do it. Don't force yourself to do something you're not comfortable with. But if you are comfortable with the risk, but you're nervous about it, then having that support group is a great way to go about it.
So it sounds like the big thing here we're talking about is overcoming that fear after you crash, right? Getting back out there if that's the next step you want to take. And the thing you guys are kind of keeping coming back to is kind of leaning on some friends to help you get through that fear.
Yeah, I think the very first most important step people need to make when they have a crash is ask themselves that important question, like, do I want to do this? I think when you make that defining decision that yes, I do, the timeline might be whatever it is for you to get back out there, or whatever the process steps might be. It might be like a progression of, you know, being on the trainer and then being on a bike path and then being on roads that you're comfortable with and then being out there with friends and then eventually being on your own, or whatever the steps might be. But most importantly, I think after a person crashes, you have to ask, do I want to do this still? you know, and some people's answer, it might, I always say, like, take a little time to answer that question. See what your answer is today, and then ask yourself that again in a month's time. Because I've even had friends who were recently hit by cars in races, and obviously their family and friends and themselves, their immediate answer right now is like, oh no, like, it's just not worth the risk, right? But a month from now, your answer might be a little bit different. So continue to ask yourself that question, like, do I want to do this? Now, if your answer is yes, I do still want to do this, which was the question I was asked, and that was my answer, then at what rate you take and what process steps you take to get back out there, that's going to be individual to every person's experience of what they went through and what their personal fears are and how you overcome them. I have another crash that I had that was on dirt following someone's wheel, and I hit a massive ditch and my front wheel like busted and flatted really fast, and I wiped out really hard, and I still am having trouble getting over going fast downhill on the dirt because I feel like I can't see if there's a pothole. On the road, you can, for me, I'm like, oh, on the road I can see them, you know, but on the dirt, I feel like I can't see them. So now I have that fear still, and it's going to take me a lot longer. That was like over a year ago. It's still taking me a lot longer to get over that crash versus getting hit by a car from behind. I'm well and truly over that. That for me was easier to get over than this one. So I think once you make the decision that, yes, I want to do this, then figuring out what your steps are going to be important.
And also, I think your risk tolerance and like where that fear that you've rationalized, where you lie in that can change over time, right? Maybe it's not worth it anymore for you to go fast on downhill on dirt. And like, maybe it will never be worth it again. And maybe that's fine. Like, you know, if you're going to do some gravel racing, maybe that's something you need to work on. But maybe you can say, okay, like, these are the risks I'm willing to take, and these are the risks that I'm no longer willing to take. And that can be like a moving target. And yeah, I don't see anything wrong with that. I think that I've noticed that a lot with myself as I get older and have people that actually depend on me to be able to function, that there are definitely some risks I used to take where I'm like, okay, it's no longer worth it for me to take these risks anymore. And I think that, you know, that can be a progression over time, and you can kind of go back and forth, right? Maybe coming back from an accident, there are a lot of risks you're not willing to take. You have some fear that you're like kind of working through it. And then, you know, maybe you can kind of move that needle, but then maybe over time the needle moves back. And yeah, I don't know. I kind of see it as like, as a gauge on different areas that can move.
And one thing to keep in mind is if you've just crashed, or, you know, you're talking to a friend who's just crashed, is everyone's skill level is different. So like the relative level of danger is also based on your skill level. Right. And you just have to kind of keep in mind that if you're talking to someone who's a relatively new rider and they crashed, what they consider might be dangerous and in your head is extremely basic. You have to put yourself in their shoes and realize that certain skills, even if it's just like a right hand corner, like, you know, riding with one hand off the bar or something like that, it might be pretty terrifying. And that in and of itself makes it more dangerous for that person. So if you are trying to help somebody who's coming back from a crash, always make sure that they're comfortable doing the next move at their own pace. And one of the best ways to do this is actually something I learned from one of my college professors who was a cross-country ski. He was the US Nordic combined coach for 15 years. So that's when you do the ski jumping off the giant ski jumps, which I right now live next to in Utah. And then also in cross-country skiing, where you're going, you know, you're on skinny skis, there's not a lot of control. And so sometimes people would crash on their skinny skis in a cross-country ski race. And then people would be like, oh, I'm no longer comfortable going 30, 35K an hour downhill on these skinny skis that have no edges and you can easily crash. And so how did he get his athletes to get more comfortable? You'd say, okay, well, this is a 200-foot hill. And he'd take them to 10 feet and say, are you comfortable riding down at full speed from 10 feet to the bottom? And sometimes they would be, and sometimes they wouldn't, but most of the times they would be. And you do that a couple times, then you move them up to 15 feet. Are they comfortable there? And you go, and you kind of just keep taking those baby steps. And you can do that a lot. Like, you know, it, if you're not comfortable around cars or just being on the road in general, you do that in like a, in a neighborhood with almost no cars where you see one car going 20, are you comfortable with that? And you can kind of get more and more used to certain things, just the same way you learn how to take a corner at 30 miles an hour. And I think we all do that. And I know you guys do that functionally, but I don't know if it's always said out loud, like, hey, take your baby steps and really take it slow. And once you get comfortable with those baseline movements, it makes everything else easier and it really builds your confidence. And then all of a sudden crashing is not necessarily in your brain because you're trying to execute a skill as opposed to worry about something that could happen.
Yeah, totally. It's like every time your skills improve, you're going to be able to predict. Well, one, you're just going to be better at preventing crashing from happening. And you're exactly right, Elliot. You know, when you ride in a group, you can tell who the beginners are and you see them do things that you're like, oh God, you're almost afraid for them that they're going to crash. Cause you can see as an experienced rider that what they're doing is unsafe and they maybe don't even know. So knowledge is power, right? The more we can improve people's skills by doing skills clinics, skills on the grass, improve their, you know, their awareness of the road, their surroundings, the cracks in the road, the dirt in the road, all the different things that are possibly hazardous that they might not even be aware of. So knowledge is power, skills is power. And the more they are comfortable with that, the better they're going to be and prevent some of these crashes. Some of them might be preventable that they, you know, they don't even know if my front wheel hits a big rock, I could go down. Or if some people can be in a position where they potentially could crash, but their skills are so good that they save it, right? How many times have we said that? Man, whoof, got out of that, right? Like I could have crashed there, rubbed wheels or got stuck in a crack or something, but you managed to get out of it and you didn't crash because your skills are so good. Whereas someone else might be in the exact same predicament and they go down pretty hard because they don't have the skills to get out of it or didn't have the awareness to know that's a potentially dangerous position and to get out of there. So I think that's a really important thing in terms of people being in a better position to not crash in the first place. And we, you know, always working on that thing, those things, and encouraging, you know, our athletes as coaches, like what to do and how to do it, how to descend properly, what to be aware of, how to ride in groups, those kinds of things, what to do in rain and sand, slick roads, wet paint, all of these kinds of things, railroad tracks. Like if people know how to handle that stuff, they're going to crash less. So those are really important. So there's the preventative side that we can do. And then there's the ones that you have no control over, like the accident my friend and I were in, where it was just a car from behind. You know, you can't prevent that kind of thing or randomly. And then it's the, okay, this has happened now. So now how do we get over this and get back to a place that is where you want to be, whether it's better than before or the same as before, or just a place where you're comfortable being back out there at whatever level that is. Like you said, Jesse, you know, it might not be at the same risk level, but you're comfortable with where you're at now.
Yeah. I think a big part of that is really like whether you're talking to yourself, whether you're talking to a friend, a coach, but really acknowledging like what happened, what you're scared of, get into the why you're scared of it. And then like kind of going through what Elliot was talking about, those steps in moving forward. Like once you've identified your fear and you've kind of like rationalized where that comes from, or whether you think it's rational or not, you've gone through that thought process, and then you can kind of unpack it and you know, take those steps in order to kind of go a little further to, you know, taking on a little bit more risk a little bit at a time.
And I think, you know, if you're supporting someone in that position, remember, you know, you've got to be patient. And just because it might be to you like, oh, hey, just get over it, you shouldn't be afraid anymore. You know, you're not that person. They've experienced some trauma, and whatever pace it takes them to work through that and get to the point where they feel comfortable again, you need to really be supportive of that and not get frustrated with them. And let's say like, okay, what is it that is holding you back here? What is it that's, like you said, what is it that's scary for you right now? Like, how do we get you to that place versus, you know, like I said, it might take one person 2 months. It might take someone 3 years to get back to the same place. Another person might just make the decision, hey, it's just not worth it to me. So if you're in a place where you're supporting someone going through that, it's you need to be careful about what your role is in that, how hard you push them. And then if it's not necessarily always about pushing them, it might be just about understanding and supporting that everybody goes through trauma and recovery from trauma at a different rate.
Yeah, the old just follow my line and you'll be fine.
No,
probably not a good plan. Not a good plan.
I was going to say like, oh no, it's fine. It's just like off of what Marilyn was saying, just it's always better in these crashing, coming back to crashing. The same way with swimming, honestly, and someone who doesn't know how to swim, who's like afraid of drowning, it's always better to do too little than too much. You know, 1% too much and you're putting someone in that fear area can just do a ton of damage. Whereas 1% too little, who cares, you know, or 10 or 20% too little. Like that means you're still doing 80% of something and you're getting something done. And that just makes the person who's trying to come back that much more comfortable. And comfort is exactly what we're shooting for. And when you're comfortable, you're able to pay attention to more things. You're able to be more aware. And maybe if you take some Venga CBD, you'll be less anxious about it. That was good. I'm really proud of myself. And you'll be able to like really focus on the task at hand and ultimately focusing on your situation and your environment, whether it's the road surface, it's the wind, it's your tire pressure changing. You know, like we all know people who've had, a slow leak and then they crashed because they had a slow leak, but they thought they were just tired. So they thought their tires were riding the same way they were, or the road surface changes, that changes how everything's going. And the same way that car traffic and the riders around you, you know, a rider around you, you are not in control of them. And just because they were pedaling like XYZ does not mean they will continue to pedal like XYZ. And that's your job to pay attention to it. And yelling at somebody for changing how they're pedaling, you know, if you're their coach and they have no clue what they're doing and they're jamming on brakes, that's one thing. But if somebody's just going from spinning to standing, that's on you to pay attention. So.
Yeah. I mean, you guys were talking about when you can see those people in the group, you see those people that have a lot of tension and like, you know, they're holding stress and, you know, that's just like a feedback loop, right? Where you start like dumping cortisol in your brain, you get even more tense. And whether that's in a group ride setting or just because you're with traffic for the first time in a while, like that's not that comfortable feeling that Elliot is talking about, right? That's what you want to avoid. So you want to take a step back before people get to that point where they're too stressed and tense to make those good decisions. Do you guys want to roll into ways people can be a little bit safer on the road? Like what are some preventative measures that maybe could be put in place? And I know like Marilyn, some things are pretty hard to prevent, like being hit from behind is, but I guess one thing that they do have now is that Garmin tail light that alerts you to cars coming. And in your situation, I don't know if you could have done anything if you knew a car was there, but you might have a second to say, oh geez, this is going to happen.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there is things like that. Like you said, just you're reading my mind there that, you know, the Garmin that lets you know those kinds of things. And that might give you a chance to, you know, veer off into the ditch or something like that if you know what's coming up behind you. Just that acute awareness of what's going on around you. I like to try and teach riders, you know, when you're standing at a magazine stand, you're looking at the magazine that you're possibly going to purchase and flipping through it and scanning the articles. However, you're aware of all the other things happening around you. You know, the people walking on the street, you know, the other people at the stand, you see the person at the register, those kinds of things. So you have this, yes, I'm focused on me and what I'm doing right now in this moment, but you have a very acute awareness of everything that's happening around you. So in a group, you know, hey, there's someone, you know, someone coming up behind me, there's someone right on my wheel, there's someone, you know, I can see through the front hub in front of me, I'm aware of, you know, the dirt on the side of the road, I can see through the wheels in front of me. So you're always very aware. You're also aware of the traffic, you can see what the cars are doing, you can hear cars coming up behind you, you're aware of what the cars are doing on the side. So, you know, just sort of like eyes on the fries, right? Like you have some awareness and not just zoning out and just focusing on your computer or your watts or something like that. I think, you know, that's an important part.
I agree. We lost Jesse.
Jesse just disappeared on us. He's out. So
he's down. I agree with you completely. And you just, everything you were describing was making me think of like Jason Bourne in a movie or like some sort of spy, right? But then if you've been riding long enough, maybe I didn't really realize it till you were describing it, but yeah, you are paying attention to everything, you know, and you didn't even mention weather or wind gusts. and all those different things. And, you know, the more people you ride with, the more you have to pay attention to. But then the one great thing is, like, if you're in a race and the road is closed, all of a sudden cars become something you don't have to pay attention to. And then you can pay attention to other things. But you're just always focused. And so
you're predicting things that are coming up, right? Like if you're even in races, if you're aware of what's going on at the aid station, like you're kind of predicting and aware, like, oh, hey, there's these, all these people on the side, they're handing bottles. What are these riders doing? You're always in that mindset of, you know what the path is you're taking, what speed you're going, but you're also predicting sort of ahead of time, just like when you drive a car, right? You wouldn't drive a car down a freeway without predicting what's happening with the cars in front of you, the ones that are changing lanes, the ones that are merging onto the freeway, those kinds of things, you know, the lights that are coming ahead. So a lot of us have driven on really big freeways and heavy traffic at high speeds. It's the same kind of awareness. You wouldn't just stare at the gauges on your car and your steering wheel. You know, you're looking up the road, you're driving your car. You're also very aware of the speed that you're going and everything else coming at you. And so it's really developing that same confidence and awareness, and that can prevent a lot of things from happening. You know, you're definitely going to be in a better position if you're aware of that stuff.
Yeah. And that just, like, brings up an excellent point. Like, there's a reason 15, 16 year olds get into more car crashes than a 40 year old. Right. And it's because they have less experience. Some people want to say, oh, well, they drive to XYZ. It's almost always because they don't know what you don't know. And it's the same thing with bike riding. And that's one of the reasons why, like, if you're a newer rider, it's okay to always want to take things slowly and go from there. And just for the listener knowing, we have Jesse back. We're not going to let him talk for a bit, but we have him back. So,
you know, if you're inexperienced too, the one favor you can do for yourself is get yourself, if you've got them and you've got access to it, spend some time riding with people who are really experienced, because you're going to learn good skills. If you get 10, 20 riders together that are all beginners, it's great that you're all beginners and you're getting together. However, there's nobody there that maybe can lead the way and demonstrate, hey, this is how it's going to help you see this stuff or know how to do this or ride smoothly or have that awareness or move on your bike, those kinds of things. I like to take some of my beginners, I'm going to say, I'm going to bring you on a ride, and they'll be literally terrified because they'll look around the group going, I can't ride with these people. Like, why did you bring me on this ride? Well, the reason I brought them on this ride as their first group ride is I want them, their first experiences to be with, you know, five or six people who are all very good at handling their bikes and know how to ride really well. And even when you're scared and you're overthinking things, you will mimic the people around you. So if everybody you're with is not that experienced and they're not doing a great job with the skills and everybody's sort of struggling on that end, now it becomes a domino and a situation that is dangerous and there could be a crash. However, if you've got a beginner and you lump them in with like six riders who are really good, and maybe it's their easy day or something like that, and you let them know, hey, I'm bringing someone along who's fairly new, and everybody's on board with that, they're going to mimic what those people are doing and their skills are going to develop in a way that they become safer riders and more aware, and it gives them a better chance. So don't be afraid to reach out to the better riders. If you're like, oh, I'm a beginner, but I'm too scared to ride with this person, reach out to them and be around them.
And I didn't realize we were going to get here, but this is a great aside as to like group ride etiquette. You know, like my first group rides ever, I remember vividly, I was absolutely terrified. There were people on the ride who like had won national championships, and it was in a small town, but it was still a 25, 30 person group ride. And I'm just dangling on the back. And wouldn't you know, three guys who are, you know, very fast, came back and gave me a few pointers and basically said, you know, like, you need to shift here at this time. And if you're comfortable riding, and they're riding like three, you know, they're riding four wheels back of the last wheel with me, and saying, oh, you know, if you want, we can try to get a little closer, but you don't have to go too much, you know, don't do anything you're not comfortable with. So if you are that experienced rider, or you're that moderate experienced rider, like, it's a great thing to do for the sport and for your own safety to help that new person and take a couple seconds and just kind of give them like the time, like, hey, we don't want you to do anything you're not comfortable with, you know? But if you, you know, if you see someone maybe braking a little too early, or they're turning with their pedal, on the inside down, you know, I distinctly remember that happened to me on my first ride. Hey, buddy, came up, here's, you know, here's how you put your cranks through the corner. I want you to shift earlier and you're cool to ride three wheels back. That's fine. That all happened to me on my first ride ever. And I was like, I was terrified. I thought I was an idiot, but wouldn't you know, it didn't take me that long to figure it out because people were nice enough to kind of help me along. And so now if you are listening to this and you're like, I know this stuff, Elliot, well, please take the time to be that person to help somebody else. And then wouldn't you know, the next time they're riding, they're going to be a little safer. And then you've got a new riding buddy. So it's all a circle of life. I wish I could sing one of the Lion King songs right now, but Hakuna Matata.
Yeah. And you know what? Even for the experienced people, when you teach something is when you really know it, right? Because if you got to teach five new riders how to ride in a pace line, or, you know, you're teaching someone, you're guiding them through doing something even smoother or faster, you're actually improving yourself as well, because the more you have to explain something to someone and you see the mistakes that they're making, it'll help you improve. Cause you check, oh, hey, am I doing this? Am I doing that? Like, how do I do it? And anytime you teach something, you get better at it. So even if you're really, really experienced, then that, you know, that can be a win-win situation, like you say.
For sure.
So I don't know how long I was gone. I don't know what I missed, but I'm back. So thanks for, thanks for,
we didn't even notice. We were like, oh, he's gone, but that's fine. We got it.
So I see we got into some group riding stuff, which is awesome. What, if you were going to give like some heavy hitters to everyone, whether you're in a group, whether you're riding with traffic, whether you're riding on a bike path and there's people walking near you. I think some of the things that I like to have everyone do is, I know you guys talked about this a little bit earlier, but I don't know how much, is basically head on a swivel. So like Marilyn said, so you're always aware of your surroundings, right? You're always looking, you're always taking in what's going on, and you've got an idea of what everyone and everything is doing around you. So just
I'm going to interrupt real quick on that just to make sure that people understand what you said there. That doesn't mean actually moving your head around and looking, because then unless you can keep your bike moving in a straight line smoothly while you turn your head, awareness of what's going on around you while you look straight ahead. So your bike's going straight ahead. And then the reason I'm not trying to, like, you know, make fun here while we talk about this, but I have seen that with beginners be one of the biggest problems for crashes, is that they're riding in a straight line. And when they go to get their water bottle, or they look when a car is coming, or they're looking at their friend when they talk to them, and when they do that, their bike swerves, and that actually causes them to have an accident, either with the person they're riding with, or they hit something or whatever. So that's that. We go back to that skills is, yes, you want to be aware, but your skills need to be good enough. It's like both hands on the handlebars, looking straight ahead while you develop that awareness. Sorry to interrupt. I just thought that was a really important point, because I see it all the time with not only beginners, but pretty experienced riders.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I was actually listening to a podcast earlier today, and they were talking about eyeball training. And so, like, you know, how you hold your head, how you move your eyes while you're riding. They're talking about people that ride the trainer a lot and then working on like eyeball training on the trainer, so they have that skill when they get on the road. But I think that's just that, is like, you know, looking with your eyes, not looking with your entire body.
Yeah. Anyways, sorry I interrupted your train.
No, you're fine. You're fine.
Asking, what are our top heavy hitters to take away, is where you're going.
Yeah. And I think that's it, is like being aware, being able to see what's going on without swerving your body in your head. So you're like looking with your eyes. And then I think that one of the biggest things you can do on your bike in a group or not is being as predictable as possible. And it becomes common nature, like as you've ridden a lot, but I think that's one thing that like beginner riders maybe don't know to do as much. And yeah, I think always trying to be as predictable as possible for other riders. And then for the traffic, like if you're not signaling that you're going to turn, the cars are not going to think that you're going to turn. So you need to be as like forward thinking and as predictable as you would expect a car to be for you. Elliot, you look like you got something to say over there.
He's got a power stance. No. He's leaned in.
I'm just remembering, you know, at the start of this episode, I was trying to think of all the crashes I had, and then I remembered another one. And it was like, I was trying to help somebody else try to lead a group ride. And then I was at the back of the group ride, and this person jammed on the brakes unannounced with a group of 8 new riders. At a place that I did not ever stop and didn't know we were stopping. And I was like at the back, looking back for cars, trying to shepherd eight people. And then I turned to the front and this group of eight people were all smushed in a line because they had come to a sudden stop. And I just like rammed into the back of them. And, you know, like in the moment, I was just like, I am an idiot. Cause like rule number one is always pay attention to everything in front of you, you know? And then I was like, oh, well, you know, like, why would we stop? There would be no, even if somebody flatted, we wouldn't stop that fast. But, you know, it was like, oh, we're going to just stop randomly and not say anything. And all it takes is that 1 second looking behind you. So you really have to know the scenario. But anyways, Josh, if you're listening, you definitely shouldn't have done that. And Elliot, me, myself, I should have given more space. I would say it took two for that crash to happen. So anyways,
yeah, I think the being predictable part is, you know, if you're riding with other people or, you know, it's, I always try and explain it. Think of yourself as like a slinky, you know, whatever you do, everything behind you is got to follow that. Right. And so if you're, if you swerve one way, then everybody else has got to swerve that way. And so if you're on the front of a group and you swerve to the left and you're aware with that awareness that there's cars coming up the left, and now you swerve to the left and that creates a domino where the fourth, fifth, and sixth person has to be swerved way out there into the middle of traffic. Now we've got a situation on our hands where your whole, not only you, but your whole group is at risk of being hit by a car or having some kind of crash, because not only is there a swerve amongst the riders, but now you've got the later people in the group poked out in traffic. So I always encourage riders to think about not only yourself, but whatever movement you're making, whether it be to avoid something in the road or because, you know, you're trying to move in a particular way on the road because of the wind or whatever, that you're not only thinking about yourself, but you're thinking about that, that effect, whether you think of a slinky or however you think of it, that there is, there's a ripple effect to the people behind you. And so you're thinking of yourself, the person behind you, the third person, the fourth person, the fifth person, all the way, if there's 20 people in the group, how is that affecting it? And you made it really clear there, Elliot, that like what that one person did on the front by slamming on their brakes affected you way at the back. Now, yeah, there was two people involved. However, it's everybody needs to be thinking about what's happening. What am I doing? If I've got to swerve to avoid this rock and I'm going to swerve to the left, and everybody's got to swerve to the left, but there's a bunch of cars coming up on our left, we really need to think this through as a group, right? Maybe we need to slowly move to the right and point it out in the middle and everybody hold their line so that nobody gets hit by a car. So these kinds of things not only keep you safe, but they keep your whole group safe. So yeah, it can be about communicating as well, holding your line, communicating, being predictable, thinking, you know, thinking about that awareness of all the things that are happening around you.
100%.
Yeah, that communication thing is huge. I think I've seen a lot of crashes in Tucson where the group rides are big and the front people can point something out, but then that communication, that game of telephone kind of breaks down in the middle of the group somewhere. And I think it is really important, no matter where you are in the group, to be pointing or shouting things out so that everyone, that message gets passed down the line.
Mm-hmm. I do think, as long as we're on the topic, like, bright colored jerseys are probably worth your time. I'm not saying you have to have them, but the same thing with like rear reflectors, front lights, the lighting systems that are available today are a great way to stay safe. There's definitely like research out there. Like, they help. They're not foolproof. You're not going to be perfectly safe just because you have multiple flashers on you, but the chance of you getting hit by a car is significantly less. That's always like great. Like at this point, after I read that study, I basically do not ride without blinky lights, even if it's in the middle of the day. I also realized, like, kind of subconsciously, I started getting rid of all my darker colored jerseys. And for the longest time, you know, I've ridden on a lot of desolate Montana roads and it wasn't that big of a deal. But now as I go to a bit more trafficked roads, it's something that's kind of always on my mind. And the other thing is like making sure your bicycle works, you know. Is your shifting working okay? Are your brakes working okay? Is your headset in a good position? All that stuff matters. And if your bike is not functioning, you know, you have to recognize that, like, that could be something that could cause a crash.
The other thing I really like that equipment thing that you're talking about. I think it's good for people to be aware that there is some really good safety things out there. And the other thing I noticed with cars, and I think that cyclists can be, fall victim to this as well, is that you get afraid to stop. Like there'll be two cars coming and like a cyclist on the side of the road and the cars are like, oh, I can't hit my brakes because I need to stay going 35 miles an hour, which means we're all going to hit this point at the exact same time. And then it gets kind of close, right? When there's two cars passing and a cyclist.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we can do the same thing, right? If you're like, oh, like this situation feels dangerous. Like you can just stop and let the cars go by and then you can keep riding. And it's always hard, right? Because like you're riding and you know you're gonna have to reaccelerate and it's gonna be kind of hard and you don't want to stop. But I think if you're entering a dangerous situation, like being okay with, I guess I'm talking if you're riding by yourself right now, but even if you're in a group and you want to say, hey, we're just gonna pull over for a second because this is sketchy. I think that being okay with making that call is something that like cars and cyclists can be more okay with doing. You know,
oh yeah. Like, you know, the Windy Point area coming down Lemon, we descend like maniacs down that. Every time we come to that point, I always signal everyone like slow down through here because you don't know if there's going to be suddenly a family crossing the road or a car pulling out right. Or a skateboarder crossing the road or another cyclist that decided to stop and turn around or something. So I'm always just like, just slow down through this area. We can go fast the rest of the way. So I think it's making those kinds of conscious choices. They're preventative, right? Into preventative totally. Measures for sure.
Yeah. And that's kind of like the more in charge of a group you are, even if it's a group of two, you know, like that's always, if you are aware of a situation that you can make safer, like please, please do it. You know, and this even goes over to racing, you know, when you're passing people if you're in some of these big Ironmans and there's people everywhere, it's totally fine to pass people. It's fine to ride fast, but like at a certain point you have to look at the risk reward and wonder where are you comfortable and where do your skills lie? And, you know, are you going to end up in a ditch? And you put so much effort into getting fast and preparing for these races, you know, like, if you give up 1 second or 2 seconds because somebody, you know, if you're descending a mountain at 45 and someone else is descending it at 42, you think they're going super slow, but guess what? If you have to slow up behind them, you're still going 42 without pedaling. Like it's not that big a deal, but crashing is a massive deal. And you can quite literally die. And I think that's something that people lose sight of. We're talking about this, you know, cause all our personal crashes have been somewhat, you know, we're not paralyzed. We didn't break anything long-term. But unfortunately, like this can quite literally be a life or death situation. Not to put a downer on it, but just to like keep you all safe and recognize like why we're being so serious about some of these points is because we don't want anybody to get hurt. We want to have fun riding our bikes and we do want to go fast, but we want to go fast where it's safe to go fast. So that's my soapbox.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I was just in a small race a few weeks ago and there's a couple of corners and people were
there
like,
there are no small races, Jesse.
there were some athletes that were getting up in arms about braking in these corners. Cause you know, it was a two loop course. But it was just like you said, like you lose 10, 20, 30 seconds, but everyone gets through the corner safely. It's not going to be a game changer. So just keeping that, keeping your mind open for the entire race, not that one moment in time can be really important.
Yeah, I think these have all been really good points. And I think the main thing people can take away is, you know, a lot of crashes, the better you get, the more you can prevent them. And the ones that you can't prevent and they happen anyways, it's part of the game that you can come back from them. There, you can always, if you consciously make the decision, I really want to do this, I'm passionate about it, you love the sport, it is possible to come back from them. So if you've been in a bad crash and, you know, this is something you're worried about, there's strategies, there's coping mechanisms, there's ways to be coached back through getting back on your bike and being as confident as ever. So, you know, hang in there and take as much time as you need and seek out the help that you need to get back to the riding that you enjoy for sure.
Well said.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to end on is that we all talked about getting help through this process, whether it's getting help becoming a more defensive rider or getting help getting back on your bike. I'd say don't be afraid to reach out for help in any of these situations.
For sure. I feel like Tony Robbins, Marilyn, you're coming for him.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Marilyn's got to get to her cold plunge now since she's the next Tony Robbins. So we got to wrap this up.
Right. Oh my God. Thanks so much, guys. It's fun to go through this stuff anyways.
Yeah. Awesome. Stay safe out there. Bye.
Cheers.